Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick. We have a special episode for you today, and it's particularly pertinent with the recent hiring of Jesse Minter, with a guest that we've been trying to have on this show for a long time, a guy we've really been looking forward to, and a very talented guy, the former Ravens running back, Femi Iyanbadejo. Femi, how you doing?
Ken, what a pleasure, man. So happy to jump in and dive in. Love your work. Been a fan from a distance for a long time. Really excited to dig into this stuff. So thank you for having me.
Well, great topic, and really, I think up your alley. I've learned a little bit more about you, and you know, the person I compare you to when I hear about your resume, background, all the things you're doing analytically now, you remind me a lot of Dominique Foxworth. Certainly have a lot of leadership elements and certainly educational elements that are off the charts. Foxworth's educational resume is similar and outstanding. In terms of having gone, I think he spent time both at Oxford and Harvard.
Yeah, he has his MBA from Harvard for sure.
Yeah, and obviously he's been a leader of two different leagues of players, which is amazing. But I really appreciate your analysis. I appreciate you spending time coming on the show, and we'll look forward to this discussion. Jesse Minter hired by the Ravens yesterday. Ravens roots, 4 years in the building. Was as high as a defensive backs coach here. He obviously worked his way up during the system, as most coaches do. But I think one of the really nice things is he understands a lot of the structure of the Harbaugh era. What are your feelings on that?
Yeah, I mean, I like the hire. People ask me if I'm excited. No, I don't need to be excited. I need to be reassured. You know what I mean? And I think that that's what he does for me. You know, I look at his resume from Indiana State to Georgia State to Vanderbilt to Michigan. The Ravens, the Chargers. I mean, he's been a part of a national championship. His defenses have been highly rated, top five, top 10 in multiple categories, top three in some instances, number one defense in college football when they won the national championship. So clearly he's a play caller, which is what I wanted. I wanted an X and O expert on one side of the ball or the other. He definitely checks that box. When I listen to former players speak about his prowess and his interaction and his ability to be a leader and command the room. Just go look at Derwin James. You can look up what Jimmy Smith said about him. Even Travis Kelce as an opponent had great things to say about him. So he checks a lot of boxes from the top down in regard to, you know, who he's worked for, the interview process, and how I respect the Ravens front office and the fact that he's been basically calling plays for a decade. I want a head coach that's going to call one side of the ball. I was leaning toward defense. I know it's funny coming from an offensive guy, but for me, the defense was the larger, bigger issue with more holes. And so I see competence. I see accountability, and I see a kid. And he's not a kid. He's 43, right? I'm calling him a kid. He's younger than me. But the point is that he understands the gravity and the culture that has been laid. And I think he can jump right on top of it and put his own spin and his thumb on the scale, so to speak, and build on top of what John and Brian did previous to him.
Great point. And there are two I want to unpack in particular, because Webb and Shielhaas, neither of them had any play calling experience. So they would have been maybe off your list in terms of guys that you wanted, or are you okay bringing that guy in as an OC, giving him his first chance as a play caller? In the case of either one of them,
yeah, no, I would, I would want an offensive coordinator that's called plays before. I think that we're ready to win right now. Like, we need to be in the playoffs next year. We need to win the AFC North next year. Yes, there are some things that need to be addressed in regard to personnel. No doubt about that. But let's assume we get those things addressed. I want someone that's going to jump in on the offensive side that is not going to be. The moment won't be too big for them if we end up on a Monday night game in the fourth quarter with 2 minutes left and it's 3rd and 7 or 4th and 4 and we got to convert. Like, I want a guy that's already done that before. And no disrespect to Webb or Shielhaas or any of those other candidates. They seem like really talented young men that are going to do great things. But I don't want their first foray in play calling to be here with Lamar Jackson. I need somebody like a Joe Brady, a Cliff Kingsbury. There's probably other people. I really wanted Mike McDaniel. And by the way, I played for Mike McDaniel. My last year of professional football was in the UFL with the California Redwoods under Dennis Green. Mike McDaniel is an offensive-minded genius. He ran our run game. he has a branch off the Shanahan Kubiak tree that's his own branch. And very, very few coordinators can say that. So he was my top choice. Obviously, we're not going to get him now. But I need a competent play caller that's done it before in regard to who the offensive coordinator is going to be to make me feel comfortable.
All right, we'll get back to that in a moment about who your choices are, because I want to talk about that. But one of the central tenets of the Ravens DNA show we're doing here is that I think there are a lot of Ravens fans out there who have a very hard time accepting all of the good that was generated in the Harbaugh era, because they're so upset and ready for Harbaugh to be gone that they don't want to acknowledge anything. You learn in, like, when you give a deposition, for example, don't try and win the game 24-0. Try to win this game 64-60, like a basketball game. Acknowledge the good points of the other person and whatnot. And in Harbaugh, I mean, it's really hard with the record being what it is overall and the number of playoff appearances. It's very hard in my mind for people not to recognize that. And yet there's a substantial portion of the community that says, flush the whole toilet. We want a new system, new regime, new everything.
Yeah, I understand from a fandom perspective how emotional the investment is into sports. And we are very much microscopic in our emotional state and our memories. Like, I totally understand that. I make it a point, because I'm an analyst and I technically, I freelance in media. I try to be objective. I want to be microscopic and telescopic simultaneously. John Harbaugh will be in the Hall of Fame. John Harbaugh will be, his name will be hanging at M&T Bank at some point. He'll be in the Ring of Honor. There's no doubt about it. Did he underachieve? Absolutely. Did we blow too many fourth quarter leads? Yes. Was there misuse of personnel and play calling and maybe, standing by while he should have interjected himself using what was probably better decision making that would have led to more fourth quarter wins or the maintaining of fourth quarter leads that we didn't have? Did we go from an AFC championship game to a divisional game to out of the playoffs? Absolutely. The trend and slope of success was downward. There's no doubt about that. And that is true. But what we can also say is that he reinforced the Play Like a Raven moniker. He built us into a nationally respected organization and powerhouse, one of the most successful teams in NFL history. He's the 12th winningest coach in NFL history. The best thing he did, in my opinion, or at least equal to his Super Bowl championship, is that he took a chance with Ozzie and the front office and Eric DaCosta and chose a kid out of Louisville that they wanted to make a receiver or a running back, and gave him the breadth and depth and space to turn into the most prolific quarterback, in my opinion, in NFL history. Like, the athleticism that he brings to the position, Lamar Jackson is the highest rated passer in NFL history. It's him, and then it's Aaron Rodgers by maybe 0.2 of a point. The point is that John, by stepping back and giving Lamar room to breathe, that's a trick, right? Sometimes you want to be in control and you want to grab things. You want to shrink the space that you allow a player to live and breathe in. He actually stepped back and widened the aperture. That's as great as anything that he's ever done. So I'm going to look at John fondly. And yes, my brother played for John. I interned under John, but I can give the critique and I can also give flowers equally. And I will have fond and appreciative memories of John, because what he did in a lot of ways was adapt and move from a hard ass to a player coach. And some of that probably costed him his job to some degree. And he'll take those lessons and he'll apply them in New York, and we'll see where it goes from there. But I have fond memories of John. I respect John.
I appreciate that. I appreciate hearing that, of course. And I want to go back to the Jackson thing for a second, because I don't give him credit for drafting Lamar Jackson. I do really give that to Ozzie. And in fact, from what I have heard and seen, the draft room is not where I would be heaping flowers on John Harbaugh. Not that he's been bad. What I do give him credit for, and what I think the fans of Baltimore, frankly, have really unfairly tagged him with, at least in a lot of corners, are saying that John effectively has a parasitic relationship upon Lamar Jackson, that he's riding Lamar Jackson into the Hall of Fame, and it doesn't really have anything to do with him. But that is complete crap. And if you look back at the previous great mobile quarterbacks, the problem with them, and I go back to Randall Cunningham in the 80s, you go in the 90s and Michael Vick, the early 2000s, really, Michael Vick. And then you go to Vince Young in the early 2000s. Those guys, part of the reason that they weren't as successful as they could be, and Randall Cunningham certainly was not bad by any stretch, they weren't as successful as they could be because they didn't completely build the offense around them the way they built it around Lamar Jackson. And how that's manifested itself is that every running back who's played with Lamar Jackson has been an order of magnitude more successful in terms of success rate, that very important running statistic of what percentage of the time are you keeping up with the sticks. And something that I think is so unfair that they do not give Harbaugh the proper amount of praise for developing Jackson the way he did.
But let me unpack a little bit of what you said, because I think there's a very intuitive and astute distinction and nuance that you're bringing up that I think is important that we dive into a little bit. I totally agree with you on the draft room decisions. I think everyone that's been close to it says that Lamar was Ozzie's decision, right? I think that's fair to say. I think that for me, John's ability to change, and I was at some of those practices where John was old John, and I saw the angst and the pressure that when he wanted to dig in and go in on you, oh, there was nowhere to hide. I've seen him do that. But I've also seen him put his arm around Lamar, the 2.0 and the 2.5 and the 3.0 version of John, where there's this amazing clip, and I think it was at the end of a game, or it was a fourth quarter blowout, and John says, there's going to be kids all around the world from all kinds of different places wearing a number 8 jersey because of you. And oh my God, like it makes me a little emotional, because you know how cool it is to have a coach support you like that? It's pretty rare, and it probably happens more now than it did when I came into the league in the 90s. And let me make another point. I played with Randall Cunningham on the 1998 Minnesota Vikings. Brian Billick allowed Randall to be, and I think Randall, I don't know if he was all pro that year, but he was definitely a pro bowler. And we lost in the NFC championship game that year, but he knew what that older version of Randall Cunningham can do. And all he did was throw deep balls to Randy Moss, made third down conversions with Jake Reed. And Chris, how am I forgetting Chris's? Like Chris is a Hall of Famer. Chris Carter. And so, you know, and Robert Smith was the running back, and we had a devastating offensive line. So it's awesome to kind of hear you talk about how the reason those guys didn't succeed is because that mentality back then was coordinators didn't build around the quarterback; they forced the quarterback to adjust to the offense,
their system. Yeah.
Brian actually had and this is what Brian did better than anybody, in my opinion, is that he found a way. And remember, he's an XO genius. Brian was an XO genius. He is a branch off the Denny Green, Bill Walsh, George Seifert tree. That's where Brian comes from, the West Coast offense. And he understood that the ability for Randall to throw the deep ball, the ability for Randy to run underneath it, the play action that we ran off of it, the screen game that we ran off of outside and inside zone with David Palmer. And, you know, it was just amazing to watch Brian do that. And then obviously to come here, right, I have the vision of the Denny Green, Brian Billick, and also the Baltimore Raven, Brian Billick, which was very adaptive and changed over time. Brian is a true chameleon. He understood, just like Harbs did, let me get out of the way of this defense and let them go do what they go do. Let me get out of the way of Lamar Jackson and support him and let him go and do what he does. And totally different teams, but guess what? Both have Lombardis because of that ability to step back and say, let me give you room to do what you do.
Yeah. Yeah. Outstanding stuff here. And, you know, obviously we're getting a history lesson a little bit in terms of Femi's background as a player. He was a Billick guy in Minnesota who came to the Ravens. That is one of the fears we have about Harbaugh taking a lot of not only players, but also staff to the Giants. And reportedly, Harbs put in, or the Giants, I guess, put in a request to talk to 24 different people. And you know how that happened. And they're all areas of the office. It's not just the football ops side. It's all kinds of other assistants. It is coaches, but it's people as well who are in scouting, I believe, that are included in that. And they, you know, you can easily see how that developed. One of the things that the Giants would have done is say, hey, Harbs, put down the list of the guys you want. He probably, you know, literally came up with a full page of names, and they submitted that to the Ravens. So the Ravens only protected a couple from lateral move interviews. Chris Horton was one, and there's another that I've forgotten, but Chris Horton was one of the major ones. I think they want to protect Randy Brown too, because man, is he important.
I think Anthony Levine might have been another one.
You're right. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's that standard though, isn't it? I mean, it's just the way that it works. And what I love about it is that whether it is implicit or explicit, it's John's way of saying, like, I saw what you did. I love the way that you did it. I want you to come help me build this here. That's a compliment. And I see that as a compliment. Now, does it weaken the internal infrastructure of the Ravens a little bit? Maybe, but I think we're used to getting players and coaches poached from our teams. Yeah, you know what I mean? So it's not, maybe not this kind of mass exodus all at once necessarily, but I think we'll be fine. I do trust our leadership to fill the gaps. There are plenty of people that want to be a part of Flock Nation. There are plenty of people that want to come play in Baltimore. So I'm not as worried about it, but I do think that we need to recognize that there's a lot of support staff that you never get to see or hear about that are responsible for the success on the football field, right? Like, it really does take a village. And I'm happy for those folks that John singled out, because it gives them a chance to say, you know what, I'm ready for the next chapter, or no, I'm going to stay here, but it feels good that I was acknowledged. So I'm okay with it. It happens all the time, and I can't be mad when it benefits us. And so, you know, when we do it to other teams or other, you know, staff, we've done it too. You know, it's a known thing. It happens all around the league. It's just kind of part of doing business in the NFL and professional sports in general, Ken.
Yeah, a lot of turnover, I think, too, is healthy in a sense. So the comparable exchange that I want to look at in a little bit of detail, not 10 minutes on this, but you know, they moved from Roman Dmankin at offensive coordinator after the 2022 season. And Roman, I think most people said it run his course, but there's the same sort of vitriol there is for the Harbaugh departure, is that people are just like spitting up bile at their phones as they call into local radio stations talking about, you know, how terrible Roman is. Well, you know, 3 years before, you know, the year ended with the injury to Lamar, and the year ended the previous year with the injury to Lamar. And the year ended in 20 with the injury to Lamar in the playoff game at Buffalo. But Lamar basically played the whole season that year. But in 2019, I mean, the Ravens offense had been one of the most prolific in all of NFL history. They've in fact never reached that same level, which is something I kind of want to get into a little bit later. But in the years after that, Roman, you know, worked with the assets he had, which were frankly less, even though they paid less for them originally. And he still did a pretty darn good job. And there was a whole bunch of fundamentals there that the Ravens wanted to keep. And with the exchange to Monken, I think they did a very good job of layering in new stuff with Monken. That wasn't as quite as heavy in terms of the offensive use of the tight end, fullback, and OL6, but they did still use a high percentage of those personnel as a percentage of eligible receivers. But anyway, I want to get your thoughts on that in terms of we've seen this already in one case. Shouldn't that be our expectation of the change in head coaches as well?
Yeah, I think that what Greg did was he put together the most complex run game in NFL history and the most successful. There's no doubt about that. If I recall, and maybe you have it in front of you, Ken, I'm not sure, but was it 34 games maybe it was more than that. How many years of 100 yard game? Yeah, 43. Okay, I was going to say 34. It was 43, right? You know, so that's pretty prolific and pretty amazing, right? And the way that he ran zone read, QB draw, QB power with Lamar. I've always been a believer for Lamar, and this is going to be, I'm going to be a little bit tongue in cheek and silly, but you're going to get the point when I say it. Mm-hmm. I'm always about having 5 all-pro linemen than 5 all-pro skill players with Lamar. You give Lamar protection, you let him do what he does, he'll find the receivers, he'll run when he needs to, and zone read to me, I'm young enough to remember what Lamar looked like in the Buffalo game before he got banged up. He looked like Lamar. He looked like Lamar against Houston last year. Like, he looked the same. He got banged up for sure, and you want to protect him. And let's just be honest, the offensive line regressed. It did. For whatever reason, it regressed. We can get into the details why later. No big deal. But the point that I think is important here is that Greg Roman was exactly what Lamar needed at that time. Did he outgrow the system? Absolutely. Was the passing game a little too simplistic and predictable? Absolutely. But that's the NFL. I don't care how complex you are where you start. If you don't adjust and adapt, it gets predictable. Teams figure you out. You have the best defensive minds on the planet that are staying up at night trying to scheme for Lamar Jackson, right? So at some point, the passing game had to catch up to the run game, and that's what Coach Monken did. My biggest issue with Coach Monken, and I love him as a human being, and I think he's a heck of a coach. I believe in his DNA. Philosophically, he's a thrower of the football. I believe that, and that's a problem for me. That's not who we are. We are runners of the football. That's what we do here. We win inside out. We win with big bodies and destroying people and snatching their hearts and their souls. Coach Monken did that at times, but he would revert to certain play calls, personnel packages that were predictable, in my opinion, that did not show me that the run game was the priority. And we can go through different decisions throughout his time that I think show that. The margins are so small in the NFL. Yes, Lamar won an MVP, should have won two MVPs with Coach Monken. The offense last year, one of the best in NFL history, no doubt. But for me, in the biggest games, in the biggest moments, is what tells me how good your offense is. And I feel like, similar to John, when it really, really mattered, I felt like we underachieved in the very, very, very key moments. Coach Monken's time has come and gone, and now we need the next iteration. We need the third version. We had the run-centric Lamar. We've had more of the pass-centric, still run the ball Lamar. Now we need Lamar to still run zone read. We still need QB power. We still need all those things that we built up to this point. But now we need to take it to the next level in regard to how we commit to the run, but still have that dynamic passing game, those right. dynamic packages. So that's what I'm looking for in an offensive coordinator. I hope I wasn't too all over the place, Ken. I hope you can thread that needle that I'm trying to, but you see, it's like three dimensions here of growth that I'm trying to get to.
I'm going to sew this tapestry back together, this quilt back together for us as we go here. But one of the things that is very different about the Ravens offense from Roman to Lamar, the Roman offense was highly directed, highly focused on staying ahead of the sticks. And they had much better, the statistic is called drive success rate. I know you probably know it, Femi, but there'll be a number of listeners who don't. It's the percentage of times you get a first down or a touchdown after each first down. And so, for example, in the Packers game was the best of the Ravens this year. Huntley, a quarterback of all people, they knelt one of their first downs away to finish the game. But 30 out of 33 times they had a first down, they converted either a third down or a touchdown on that series of downs. The typical rate for a really a league leading rate would be in the mid to high 70s. And the 2019 team was like at about 79, and they were still behind the Chiefs that year, but they were fantastic. That's been the thing that they lost a little bit from Monken. They gained explosiveness, no doubt about it. But they lost a little bit of staying up with the sticks that I think really hurt them on defense as well, would be the thing. And that's a DNA component that I want them to regain.
Yeah, the complementary part is what you're alluding to, and I totally agree with that. It seemed like the offense and defense were very disconnected at certain times. I think that the what I'm extracting from what you're saying, and this is my kind of subjective or interpretive analysis of that, is that I would get frustrated in real time because I think that the statistic that you're pointing to is reflective of that. The idea that you're going to take a risk here, but this isn't the 2023 defense. You know what I mean? Like that defense was, I mean, what they led the league in scoring, turnovers, and sacks. Like that's not the defenses that we had the last 2 years, right? With that defense, you could take more risk and go for the jugular. But for this offense, I wanted to see a lot more first downs strung together and a lot more complementary football to protect that defense because they were just out there too much. I mean, there were games that were so lopsided because the defense couldn't get off the field on third down. And I think that with Coach Monken in play, as games went longer, third down, closing off the offenses that we were playing against with our third down defense, it got worse and worse as time went on because of fatigue, right? And that was very obvious to me. And that was a problem for me.
Yeah, so the statistic that goes with that, and I completely agree with that, by the way. The fourth quarter defense that was made very difficult by incredible deficits in snap count this year. The Ravens only ran 60 plays in a game five times in 17 games this year. That's absurd. You know, and the Ravens of the early Lamar era were beating the living snot out of everybody they faced, you know, 70 to 57 and 73 to 54 in snap count. And you know, with that reverse, it's extremely uncomfortable for the defense. And it means your game management, honestly, really has to adjust in the fourth quarter. Not your game management in terms of run pass. I'm not talking about that. I'm really talking more about how much risk you think you need to take in offense, even though you have the lead, to keep your defense off the field when you've lost snap count so badly to that point. It was actually, I thought, a significant factor in losing to the Steelers in the final game, because they had alternatives, specifically with something that would have driven people up the wall, would have been having Zay Flowers kneel down at the 1 yard line.
Yeah. It's so hard in real time to do that. And it takes a very astute coach in the moment when bullets are flying. I call it the fog of football, Ken. You know what I mean? You know, you have the fog of war, I call it the fog of football. Things are happening so fast, to be able to pause things for a moment and slow things down and go, hey, guys, whoever gets inside the 5 yard line or 10 yard, you just go down right there. We're gonna win it or lose it right here. This is what we're gonna do. Yeah, that would have driven people crazy for sure, especially if we lost the game anyway. Yeah. But I think a key thing that and I'm sure you know this, but I heard somebody talking about this today. When Kyle Hamilton was playing against the Steelers in that last game that we lost, I think they were averaging 3.7 or 3.8 yards per play when Kyle was out there.
For you right now.
And it went to, yeah, and I think it went to like 5.9 per play when he got hurt in that first series. That's what changed the game, in my opinion. If Kyle Hamilton plays that whole game, I don't think the Steelers win. The offense was doing nothing. And that's with the Linderbaum hold on Lamar that could have put us up by, I think we could have been up 17 or 13-3. We ended up getting no points on that play. Lamar had one of his longest runs of the season. Tyler did not need to grab the inside of PQ's shoulder pad. And yeah, you know what? Let me not rehash and give myself, you know, an emotional breakdown and crash out here talking about the Steelers game. But yeah, I think the Kyle Hamilton injury, the collision with Halohe Gilman, in my opinion, was the singular biggest reason that we lost that game that somehow I don't think gets discussed enough, but we are where we are now.
Collinsworth caught it on the spot, which you got to really give him credit for. I think a lot of people don't automatically, but 3.5 with Hamilton on the Hamilton snaps, 6.9 without him.
So it was even lower than I said. Yeah, it was lower and higher than what I said, which is crazy to think about. So yeah, I mean, I just, it's unfortunate, but look, this is the thing. When Coach Minter takes over, when Jesse takes over, and if we end up reaching where we need to get to and we see that we are rising to the occasion in the fourth quarter and we're getting leads and we're maintaining these leads and, you know, we get to an AFC championship game right away and we win a Super Bowl, I think the sacrifice of losing the Steelers game, we might look back on it and go, you know what, it's probably a good thing that happened, because we're on the right track now. Now, once again, this is me being optimistic and looking at the glass half full in the future. I want Jesse to have all the success, because his success is our success. And it's great for us as Ravens fans and for the community and as a former player. Like, we want all that. But sometimes you've got to give up something to get something. And maybe that loss and this kind of downward slope of performance from AFC championship to divisional round to out of the playoffs is what needed to happen to make the change that's ultimately going to lift us to where we want to get to.
Well, if the 1 week was true, it would have saved his job for a week if Lupin made the kick kind of thing. Even if it were 2 weeks that were true, it would have been a substantial difference in draft capital for the Ravens to do it. So at least they have that before you even consider the impact of coaching and the positive or negative. I mean, there is a risk involved that you know, they're bringing in a new regime, which might fumble the football, you know, in terms of doing this. I choose to be positive about it too. I think they've made a very measured, very good choice. I think they did a good job of making this open to the public. This is something they did, by the way, for the season ticket holders in 2008 when they hired Harbaugh. They sent us a thing that looks like a game day program. It was that size, and it had all this detail on how they executed the coaching search. You know, so-and-so picked him up at the airport. The first part of the interview was conducted in the van on the way back to the castle. And then he met with A and B and C and D. And they're very open about the fact that Garrett was their first choice and Harbaugh was their second. And I handed that out to the other managers at work, because I thought, you know, this is a great example of a hiring process. And it really shows that Bisciotti and now 25 years of being the principal, has only had, has only had three hiring changes he's had to make on the football operations side. He promoted DaCosta above Ozzie, and that's only like half a move because he kept him in the building. And then he had the two coaching changes. That's it in 25 years.
Yeah, you know, I think we need to be careful and watch what we wish for, right? You know, we're the model of stability. And I also think with that model of stability, we've also been risk averse in some ways. Like, we've taken chances, we've done things outside of the box. We've morphed and adapted to the current times. And I mean no disrespect. Pittsburgh is a blue blood organization. You know, maybe we'll call Buffalo a blue blood organization as well. You know, they went to four Super Bowls, didn't win any of those, but I mean, they've been successful over the course of decades. And I feel like what I love about the Ravens is that we've taken our shots, we've taken chances, and because of it, we've benefited, in my opinion. I think Pittsburgh and I think Buffalo are going to make conservative hires, and that's to our benefit. I love it. Go ahead and make those conservative hires. But we'll continue to push the envelope in Baltimore, and we'll do it with the people that have evolved over time. Eric's evolved. Ozzie's evolved. Steve, you know, coming from the business world that he comes from, as an entrepreneur, highly successful, a billionaire for a reason. I think he gives people the room and space to take chances and to take risk. And if we didn't take those chances and risk, we wouldn't have a Brian Billick. We wouldn't have a John Harbaugh. We definitely wouldn't have a Lamar Jackson. So I'm here for it. I like the idea that we will look in all areas, in all places, to find the solution to the problem. And I just don't agree with anybody in media, locally or nationally, that thinks that this 20-person interview process was all a smokescreen to hire the guy that they wanted from day one. I just don't believe that. I believe that they went through the I've heard this. It's wild stuff, you know. The people that are pessimistic, you know, those parasites that I talk about, they just can't be positive. They just have to poo-poo everything and act as if they're the smartest person in the building when it comes to decision-making. They don't talk to anybody in the building because nobody in the building will talk to these people. And the bottom line is that there's a body of work here that tells me that the Ravens are thorough in all aspects. They're going to be thorough. They're going to do their due diligence. So if this is the conclusion that they came to, they've earned my respect and my trust. And like I said, I don't need to be excited. I need to be reassured. And I think that the hiring of the head coach has reassured me that we are on track. You know,
this show is sponsored by BetterHelp.com. For some, summer is their favorite season. Travel picks up, kids are out of school, and adventure is the focus. For others, juggling it all can be tough, can make you feel overwhelmed, and can make you count down the minutes until the kids are back in school. I know I look forward to summer as a time to take a break, but as a self-employed person, time spent away from my work is time I stress over wasting. That's where BetterHelp comes in. BetterHelp is a quality therapist who work according to a strict code of conduct and are fully licensed in the U.S. BetterHelp does the initial therapist matching for you so you can focus on your therapy goals. A short questionnaire helps identify your needs and preferences, and their 12-plus years of experience and industry-leading match fulfillment rate means they typically get it right on the first time. If you aren't happy with your match, switch to a different therapist at any time. With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform, having served over 6 million people globally, and it works. With an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on 1.7 million client reviews. You don't have to say yes to everything this summer. Find support in therapy. Sign up and get 10% off at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
Onward and upward.
All right. All right. I love it. Now let's look forward for a moment and talk about the biggest things that you want to see Minter and his staff fix. And I know you won't do this, but I want this for the audience more is we're not going to focus on the outcomes, because the outcomes we already know, more playoff success and not blowing leads as being two big ones. I think more in-season success against the best teams would be good, but that's really short-sighted to not look back at 23-24 and the 19-7 record they had against winning teams those 2 years and just look, say, at last year. But we want those results to be better. But what are the fundamentals that are going to get them there, Femi?
Yeah, you know, I think that when I look at the offensive side of the ball, I just think that the run blocking, the pass protection, those were the two biggest issues for me. Obviously, the run game found its way. We ended up being the number one rushing offense in the NFL. But I think a lot of that was weighted more toward the end of the season. Obviously, there were some times, there was a lull in the middle there where we were a little bit ineffective. We started out good, we had a lull, and then we kind of finished strong. But it always comes down to the trenches, Ken. It always comes down to the offensive and defensive line. And for me, the offensive line was uncharacteristically, why can't I say uncharacteristically? Yeah. Thank you. I don't know why I'm having a tongue tie today, but they just didn't. There was just a regression there in regard to the way that it's a dance, and there is an in sync mind melding that needs to happen between play calls and what actually happens at the snap. Right? You know, I'll give you a perfect example. There are times when you have what's called a solid call. Right? The center will point out to the mic backer and say, look, this is the direction that we're going to block this pass protection in. It could be the front side, strong side, mic backer, right? Mm-hmm. But for whatever reason, the front, all five linemen are covered up, and we'll make that a solid call, which basically means that you're going to block the man that's over you. It's five on five. And if the running back is in, he'll take whoever is left. But for whatever reason, I would see the guard, usually one of the guards, two guys would end up on the same guy and there'd be a free runner. I mean, this is elementary stuff. You know what I mean? These are things that don't happen, that shouldn't happen, that have never happened before, but happened multiple times this last season. And so for me, the diagnosis, communication, X and O part, and then once again, too, like the idea that you're going to turn your body as a blocker and not stay square on your man. I saw that more often than I've ever seen it before. I don't know why that happened. I don't understand why it was happening. And I will not single out anybody right now, but the fundamental things that happened this season were uncharacteristic. And I think they're easily fixable. Some of it is new people, but some of it is also just reasserting the kind of the coaching mechanisms that needed to be put back in place. On the defensive side of the ball, losing Nnamdi was huge. Yeah. And we just, look, Jesse Minter was able to get, was it 10, 10 and a half sacks out of Adafe Owe in L.A.? But he had none here. I don't understand that. I don't understand what happened there. Maybe for Adafe, it was psychological for him and just a fresh scenery and belief in somebody, you know, going where he felt like he was wanted. Probably had some role in it. But guess what? That guy that unlocked him is coming here. Hopefully he can help unlock some players and also put players in positions to be successful. So those mechanics and just being an expert, like an X and O play caller, dynamic 3-4 base defense, very comfortable running his sub packages, being exotic. You know, he's going to run cover two. He's going to run cover six. He's going to run cover zero. He's going to run cover one. He's going to do all the things that you expect. And he's going to have wrinkles off of all these things. So I think getting back to that competency in the trenches, being an expert in play calling, being familiar in high intensity defensive play calling situations is all going to bode well for the Ravens. So that's what I'm really excited about.
So lots to unpack there. Let's start with the offensive line. And George Warhop did some very good things over the last 2 years, most notably reducing penalties. They worked very hard on getting the line of scrimmage quickly so Lamar can make reads there, getting out of their stance quickly, using multiple cadences. They cut their false starts from 24 to 19. That's just the tip of the iceberg in terms of what their cadence gains were in 25. Unfortunately, it wasn't enough unto itself to really create an efficient offense, but it was a very high focus during last year's camp. They did those set and snap drills. No helmet, you know, I'm sure you know it from way back in the day, but they don't go a helmet, get the play in, get to the line of scrimmage, get off as quickly as possible. And they're grading all that. But they're not, you know, handling any of the contact. But getting back to Warhop for a second, he's 64 years old or whatever he is, approximately that age. Isn't it time to like find the next great dynastic offensive line coach who will take you from 42 to 60. And that's a position, by the way, you don't have to replace that guy. If you've got a system that loves the run, that guy doesn't have to be elevated to an offensive coordinator. A lot of them don't even want it.
Yeah. You know, I think in regard to the dynastic part is that, you know, a lot of what we do should be carried over. Mm-hmm. I, there's a little bit of a fear that a new coordinator, I'm hoping that he doesn't have a kind of like my way or the highway approach. I don't think we would hire somebody like that, but we hang our hat on the run game, right? So we have been sort of dynastic in that sense based on just the data and the performances, right? But I also want dynamism. And I think that's what Joe D brought, right? Joe D was a dynamic individual. I don't know how old Joe D was when he passed away, but we're neighbors actually. I would see him. I live in Harbor East, right downtown. I'd run into him at Starbucks. I'd run into him, you know, crossing the street, like over there by Haagen-Dazs here in Harbor East. And we would always chop it up. Oh my God, what an amazing. And when I say dynamic, that is not hyperbole. Joe D was, my goodness, such an amazing human being. And I think when he passed, some of that went with him, you know? And I don't know Coach Warhop at all. I just know the results that I saw, right? And I don't think we need to do, and once again, I give him credit for all the things that we did well and improved on for sure. You know, I'm a player's player, and I'm a player's coach from the standpoint that like I love coaches that coach me hard and coaches that, you know, that it really means a lot to them. And I'm sure that Coach Warhop is all those things. My concern would be that we get some outlier offensive coordinator. When I say outlier, I mean outlier in his thinking. He sees it differently. Now, if it works, then great. But we can't change what's made us who we are. I know that it's important to me from a DNA perspective. It's important to me from a cultural perspective. And I think it's important to you as well. Please build on what we've already put in the tank. Don't come in here with the idea that you're going to do it better or differently and because you're you. And that to me, that's ego-driven. We don't need ego, right? We need people that understand what it means to play like a Raven and how that was built.
I could not agree more. And it's very well stated that, you know, they want to build and layer in to the things that they've done well already. And, you know, to throw it all out, honestly, would be a complete slap in the face to the Harbaugh success. It'd be foolish. Now, I think there's going to be enough people left in the building. And I think that the similarity of Minter's starting position is similar enough that he'll come in and he'll layer on good things onto what they do. They had the same sort of a dynamic slot corner slot in Derwin James that they have with Kyle Hamilton. You know, they have a desire to run similar fronts. And so I think we'll see that. They have a desire to run some similar coverage as well. And they have no fear of big nickel as being the most commonly used package. So like between all of those things, I think there's enough that they're going to start basically with the notion that Kyle Hamilton starts at slot corner. And once you do that, the other pieces will fall into place in terms of how you want to arrange around him and derive value from him. I think they'll do a good job of that. That's my personal take.
You know, I agree with you. And I do think whether it's through free agency or the draft, we need a game closer at the rush end spot, the edge position that has to be addressed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I wish I had more line of sight on Nnamdi. I wish I could say more or knew more about his situation. But, you know, I think we agree that you got to build from inside out. And I know that's usually coach speak and everyone always says, oh, you got to start in the trenches, but that's who we are. That's how we do business. And so it's also going to be really interesting to see, you know, does Alohi get re-signed or I don't even know, is he under contract, Ken? I'm not sure.
He's not under contract.
Okay. So I wonder what happens with him. I also wonder what happens with Marlin. You know,
I was just going to ask you. Marlon's under contract for $7 million. Alohi Gilman, I don't know what he can be had for, but I assume, you know, 2 years, $6 million kind of thing would be that would be an amount that I'd be ambivalent towards. Honestly, I'm frankly more excited about Marlon moving to safety at this point. I think there are so many potential advantages from that. In start because if you look at Marlon's play style, he's an off man. Interceptor, meaning it's not his coverage assignment. Not that he's 8 yards off the ball at the snap. That's been a frequent frustration of fans. But he brings skills already from the cornerback positions. I think would be very portable to being a center fielder, to being a split field player, or even a single high free safety potentially. There are questions about the tackling. Some of that I think might have been injury related this year. And there's also questions that should we really be moving Marlon this quickly, given he's only had one bad year after an AP 1 year in 24.
I think that the lack of pressure really hurt the DBs, right? Those things are married, right? What is the best sign of a good DB. It's a good pass rush. You know what I mean? Like usually those things are married together. And the fact that we, you know, we were one of the worst in the NFL when it came to pressure rate, especially organic pressure with, you know, rushing four or less, right? We were one of the worst in the league. So you can't cover guys for 4 seconds. It's just impossible. You know what I mean? And so if you move Marlon to safety prematurely, like what does that do to Malachi? What does that mean for Alohi? What does that mean for Kyle? Obviously, we know Kyle is the true, you know, Swiss Army knife. You can kind of put him anywhere, and we know he's going to be successful. But if you address pressure and you address the front seven and finding, and I know from schematics like X and O's, I think we're going to improve naturally just because of what Jesse does. I believe that. But also the personnel side of it. If you address it from a personnel perspective, does Marlon become 2023 Marlon? You know, one of the most impressive games from our defense that I recall was the 2023 game in San Francisco. Was that Thanksgiving or Christmas or when?
Christmas.
Christmas.
Four interceptions.
And I remember just DBs, you know, up in the air, balls getting batted up in the air, you know, interceptions, pressure, chaos, fumbles. Like to me, that's how I envision Marlon. That's who I think he is, right? And I still think he can tap into that. So I'm hoping that through improving the pass rush and Jesse's, you know, intelligence on the defensive side of the ball, that some of these guys that we think, you know, had down years, their 2026 numbers improve just because of the competence and the addressing of personnel.
Okay. I mean, that's reasonable. And I think the combination of pitching and defense are intertwined just as much as coverage and pass rush are, in terms of you can't separate the two. Every linkage you break down, you'll still find more. So it is possible between the combination of the difficult situation he's put in by the pass rush and the number of injuries he had, that he could be back to being a good player, because he's not completely, he's 29 this year, I think, right? So he's not so old that you wouldn't worry, but he is old enough that you have to start worrying about decline. And at the cornerback position in particular, I need to start worrying about decline. And a lot of those guys do end up moving to safety. It did wonders for Rod Woodson's career to move. And, Marlon could be a cop for that.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I heard in regard to on-field data, I think that Marlon went into this season running as fast as he ever has in regard to just his athleticism and the tracker data. I think I recall hearing this actually. So I don't believe it was an aging issue. I do think it was an injury and a lack of pass rush issue, the same way that I think Lamar's season was kind of derailed a little bit due to pass protection. But remember, when Lamar started the season, I think he had 10 touchdown passes and one interception. He had the highest QB rating in the NFL. And then when he came back and wasn't protected and wasn't 100%, then we kind of saw his season be a little more kind of up and down. You know what I mean? But I think that was more of a symptom of the offensive line than a regression in Lamar losing his superpowers. Like, I just don't believe that. I have eyes. I saw what he did when he was healthy. And you have... I love track. My son is a track athlete at the University of Maryland. I love watching sprinters. You have sprinters today that are Olympians that are running sub 10 second hundreds, PRing in their mid and late and early 30s. You know what I mean? So Lamar's speed and his agility at 29 when he's healthy should be as good as it ever was or is, as long as he's training, which I know he trains. So I expect Lamar to be full powered, super Lamar in 2026.
Well, track athletes are probably a little different. You're absolutely right. You look at Usain Bolt or whatever, he's gotten better with age in some ways, but track athletes aren't getting hit. And that's, you know, one of the issues with Lamar. I'm not blaming this on Lamar by any stretch. But I think the Ravens offensive line was below average, but not so far below average that Lamar couldn't have bailed them out. But once the injuries started happening, it destroyed the Ravens' run game misdirection fuel. And that's misdirection fuels this Ravens offense, and the run game in particular, but also the rest of the offense too, because you the run pass options go off it, and all your play action runs off it and whatnot. So you know, it's a shame that that was lost this year. I certainly don't blame Lamar, and I also don't think it's a concession to age, given that he goalposted the season with such high level of play, both in the Pittsburgh game in that fourth quarter and to start the season, as you mentioned, that I think he'll be back if you know when he has months to rest before next season begins.
Yeah, I think Ken, you made a good point, and I want to make sure I dig into this a little bit. The zone read concept with Lamar as a runner fuels everything.
Yeah.
If you cut off your left arm, which is to me like, you know, that's a big chunk of your body and how you would you know, fight your way through the world with one arm, right? And I'll compare that to the playbook. Imagine just cutting out that part of the playbook. There's a downstream effect on all the rest of the plays at that point, because as a defense, you feel like that threat is gone. Yes, Lamar can still run and take off, but any quarterback can run and take off. If you're playing cover one with your back turned, you see green grass, yeah, you go get it. Okay, we expect all quarterbacks to do that. But that's not – we had design runs that were taken away. Those design runs lead to the RPO going away, which then leads to a complete different philosophy on how you play the Ravens, because you don't feel threatened by those things at that point, which I think then it completely just changes all the different options on the menu, so to speak, right? And so I think that's problematic. I think what makes Lamar so dynamic and unique is you just don't know what he's going to do and when. And I just want access to the full playbook moving forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And the three key statistics on that really give a flavor for the 2025 Ravens is their yards per carry for the running backs were down, but the success rate for the running backs were down. Henry was a near historic 58.8% last year, which was the third highest ever, I believe, for 300 plus carries. Might have been the second highest ever, but Bijan Robinson actually set the record last year. And then the number two is that Lamar on his designed runs ran for only 3.5 yards per carry this last year. I mean, in what world is that okay? And in what world would an uninjured Lamar Jackson ever have anything like that? He was still okay as a scrambler, a little bit less prolific than usual and a little bit less in terms of yards per carry at 7.3. But for the first time in his career, his combination of sacks and scrambles ended up being a negative number, negative 0.3 yards per play, which is what I call forced not to pass, or maybe it should be called forced to run when a quarterback is not able to throw for a pass. He'd been in 2019, Lamar had 5.6 yards per play when you combine his sacks with his scramble. It's just how incredible that is just, you know, another world. I've mentioned this a number of times on the show, so a lot of the listeners will already be able to say this one, off the top of their head. But Lamar's career is at 3.2, which is almost the greatest ever. And I think that the Josh Allen is right there with him in terms of that. But it really showed up all over in terms of, you're exactly right about that misdirection when lost affected a whole bunch of elements.
Yeah, and you know, I can't put my finger on it completely, but I do think that some of the points that I made about the downstream effect of eliminating part of the playbook was huge. But it just felt like there was something systemic that put us on this trajectory. And it might not be right, but I'm gonna say it anyway. I do think that our emotional and psychological positivity was really kind of snatched from us when Derrick Henry fumbled in that Buffalo game.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I really, like, if I can pin it down to, if I could say, I just want to eliminate one play from the whole season, that's the play that I would eliminate. Cause I think it just puts us on a different future, a different path. But like I said before, I gotta own my own words and take my own medicine. Maybe it would have just delayed the inevitable and we would have been here anyway at some future date, which is fine. But I do think that the Detroit game was also eye-opening for me, because off the top of my head, I don't have it in front of me, I think Lamar was pressured 37 times in that game.
There might have been a total. That sounds like a PFF total pressure.
It is a PFF number, by the way. Yes.
Let me, as we're making the next point, I'll try and track down that and have it by the end of the show here. But we need to kind of tie this together. And I want to ask you, who are your favorites for the coordinator positions now? Does it matter on the defensive side? And who would you like to get on the offensive side?
Yeah, let me start with defense because it's easier to answer. I would not be upset if Jesse decided to bring a young protege that has got a brilliant mind that's never play called before and make him the D coordinator with the idea that it'll pay dividends later and it'll push him later to be better because he believes that the person that he brings in is just next level brainiac savant style defense. I would be okay with that. I'd also be fine because I assume Jesse's going to make the play calls. That's my assumption. But if he decided he wanted to go with a veteran guy that's going to help him just for support, I'm kind of okay with that too. So to answer your question about defense, I can rationalize any decision they make as long as they tell me the reason why. I'd be fine with it. On the offensive side, and I alluded to this earlier, I probably jumped the gun a little bit, but I need a competent play caller that's been there, done that, and seen it. Mm-hmm. So for me, that Webb is out, Shieldhouse is out, Clay Kubiak is out. Kingsbury is in because he's been mm-hmm. a competent play caller. Joe Brady is in play. And when I take a poll around the league and I source different commentary about Cliff Kingsbury, I recall his time in Arizona early days with Kyler being pretty good, but the problem is it tailed off. I recall what he did with Jaden Daniels, prolific offense for a rookie, like the best we probably ever seen from a rookie, just in regard to his full competence of running a system, running the ball, throwing the ball, third down conversions, pass completion percentage, all the different numbers. He did a great job with Jaden. Obviously, he was hurt, but even with Marcus Mariota, did a pretty good job last year with him as well. And when I look at guys like Hollywood Brown and I hear the internal thumbs up from players like Lamar and the receivers, there seems to be some level of consensus around Cliff. If they're good with Cliff, I'm good with Cliff. I thought Joe Brady called a heck of a season for the Bills. And I don't think the Bills had the most talented roster. Yep. I think Josh Allen is really, 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 really good. One of the best out there. And James Cook is absolutely one of the best out there. And their offensive line is really, really good. But I think Joe Brady's got some real skill. And I was really paying attention closely. I made it a point because I thought Joe Brady could end up being a coordinator here. He could end up being a head coach here. So I really watched his play calls in that playoff game against Denver. And I thought he did an outstanding job putting his players in position to make plays. And how about that hook and ladder? My goodness.
Yeah, that's
he
a
is
weird
not
play.
Afraid. Yep. No, I think it's a great call. I mean, it just shows me a risk averse. Like you got to take chances to win games. I liked it. I thought it tells me something about his mindset and his fearlessness. And I think in the NFL, fear leads to more losses than wins. Yeah. I believe that. I watched the play calling. I watched the conservatism late in games. And it's just like, no, fourth and one, I don't care if you're on your side of the 50. You can end the game on your terms right there. Go do it.
Okay. So two things. First of all, I'll give you the numbers from the Detroit game as I have them. I have Jackson as having ample time and space, which means a 3-second pocket, room to step into his throw 8 out of 35 times, 23%. He was pressured. Let me get to this total. Where is that now? Yeah, delivered the ball before pressure could develop. 8 times, he was pressured 19 times, 54%. It's very high, by the way. Now, PFF may have ascribed multiple pressures to a number of those plays, which gets you up to the 35. So I think that's where we're talking about.
Yep.
And by the way, there were worse games for Jackson being pressured than this one in 2025. There were definitely ones where he had one where he's at 8%, I think, for the game, which is the lowest I can ever remember. So,
Which game was that? What game was that?
I have to work through my offensive line articles here, which I have.
Okay, no worries. No worries.
I'll do it another time, or maybe we'll look at it right after the show here. But but anyway, I've kind of lost my point. I'm with you on having a play caller. So Kingsbury, Brady would be two of your guys. Brady looks like he might get the Buffalo game. If they could get Clint Kubiak, you'd be excited about that, no doubt.
Well, yeah, I mean, I just assume that Clint wouldn't make a lateral move, though, would he? Right. I mean, do you think he would make a lateral move? I don't think he would. Like, why would you?
So,
go ahead.
They could pay him more money, so that would be one possibility. He could work with Lamar Jackson. That could be another reason why he'd want to do it. But they'd have to do something like at least nominally to make him assistant head coach, which doesn't really mean anything. But I don't know if that's really qualifies as a lateral move. I don't know how the how teams allow other teams to not interview their guys, or what are the rules around them blocking those interviews?
Yeah, I mean, you know, how about Clay Kubiak?
Yeah,
right.
I mean, I'm okay.
Yeah, Clay Kubiak, as a, you know, Clay has not, Shanahan calls the plays though, doesn't he? Not Clay. Wait, Clay's in San Francisco, right? Under Shanahan. Or is he in?
Wait, he's in Seattle, right? Or maybe I'm wrong.
So Clint's in Seattle, but Clay, I think, is Clint's brother, younger brother. I think Clay is either in San Francisco.
He's with the Niners.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. He's with the Niners. Okay. Yeah. So Clay is technically, I believe, the offensive coordinator, but I think all the Shanahans are confusing me. There's a Mike Shanahan who's a college coach. There's Mike Shanahan, like the older Mike Shanahan, right? And then there's obviously his son, who's the head coach for the 49ers. My point is that I don't think that Clay Kubiak calls the plays in San Francisco. I think Shanahan calls the plays. Mm-hmm. So based on that, that kind of eliminates him for being the offensive coordinator here in Baltimore for me. But Clint, yes, sorry. Clint, to answer your point, yes, I'd be happy with Clint as the offensive coordinator. I love the Kubiak Shanahan, which is the Bill Walsh, Brian Billick, all that's all that same system, right? You know, Mike McDaniel, right? They've all kind of added to it and all those different things I mentioned earlier. I'd love to have him here. And I love the dual-headed monster they have in Seattle at running back. I know Charbonnet is going to be out, you know, obviously with the injury, he's not going to be playing, but I'm okay with that. I think they're going to be just fine. I think that Jackson Smith and Jigba is a top two or three receiver in the NFL. And when I watch him play, I'm just blown away by the body control and the catches that he's able to make. Sam Darnold has made the most of his opportunities. Mm-hmm. Remove Sam Darnold and put Lamar Jackson in that position. I mean, mind blown. You know what I mean? I think, and then you have Derrick Henry back there. Do you know what Keaton Mitchell could do in a Shanahan Kubiak offense? It would be bonkers what would happen with him. I get excited just thinking about it.
He did it for 47 carries or whatever it was in 2023. He was as exciting as you could hope him to be. I mean, it's the best season by DVOA and 40 plus carries in NFL history. So it's a remarkable. I'm a big fan of Keaton Mitchell. By far the most dominant player. And I really couldn't understand other people not seeing this, but they cut on a dime. Usually I can't tell with the running back in camp because they're not going to full contact. You're not getting a lot of the missed tackles force component that you'll see with the Derrick Henry, because he's not stiffing arming anybody. In fact, nobody's standing in front of him. So it's hard to tell somebody's a running back. Wasn't hard to tell with him at all. Not at all.
Yeah.
Transition from catch to run also was outstanding in camp.
Yeah, he needs to definitely work on his route running for sure. I think that if he can be a weapon on third down running, you know, QB option, I'm sorry, halfback option, halfback angles, fake angles, pivot routes and different things like that. You know, all he's got to do is go look at Detroit. You know what I mean? Go look at what they do in Detroit, you know, and I think that, you know, Keaton can be a version of that. I see the skill set. Obviously, I'd like his hands to be a little bit more polished, but that's just getting on the jugs. That's just repetition. He has the skills to do it. It's just it's time and commitment. You know what I mean? And so, you know, obviously I played with Anthony. I love Anthony. Anthony's an amazing guy. He raised a great kid. I got to meet Keaton and speak with him and just kind of just encourage him to keep leaning into developing his skill set as a well-rounded running back. I know he has confidence in himself. And, I chopped it up with him for like 15 minutes during our reunion weekend at practice one day. I got a chance to talk to Teddy Buchanan for a little bit, which was awesome as well. I love these young kids that the Ravens have. I think the future's bright.
Okay. All right. Well, wonderful. I think we have to call it there. Femi, I've appreciated this conversation, let alone, you know, just having a high quality guest, but the conversation just wonderful for this last hour. Tell folks what you're up to now and anything you'd like to plug at all.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I've got my hands in a lot of different things as you alluded to. You know, I did my MBA at Hopkins. You know, my focus is digital health and agentic AI and AI and using different tools to, you know, create diagnostics and guidance around nutrition and exercise, health checks and different things like that. I can go down a rabbit hole on that, Ken. I won't, but I think one of the best things about coming back to Maryland, I've been back here 12 years now, you know, being able to go to Hopkins, I've had contracts with NASA for consulting work. My practice in general, my consulting work, I can work with any organization, any company. I have a website, FemiTheConsultant.com, if you're curious about that. I do a ton of keynote speaking. And ObaFemi30 on Instagram and X, if you want to reach out to me there. And I'm always, you know, I do stuff at The Fan. I do stuff with 98 Rock. I do Purple Power Hour with Kirk and Marianne on 98 Rock. You know, I do stuff with Bruce Cunningham at The Fan on the weekend sometimes. So I'm kind of everywhere. So I appreciate the chance to give myself a little plug, but yeah, hey, I'm here, you know.
Outrageous, and we're really happy to have you. Other folks out there, thanks so much for listening. As always, use hashtag Film Study Mailbag for questions. I'll direct them to the appropriate show, do a 1 to 3 minute video on them, or perhaps I have you on for a short if you want to discuss that at a future time. Femi, thanks again for coming on.
Thanks again.
And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.